Well, we have a long list already, and Robert Draper, you're up first, and Will Salatin, and Byron, and David, and Michael, and Carl, and Emma, and Sarah, and Shadi. Go ahead, Robert Draper, over.
Thanks, Dan. You said something near the end about you'd said why is there this pushback among young evangelicals when there are several options available? And you were talking about evolution, but it occurred to me from the phraseology of the question that which sounded so familiar to me that you could have been asking the same thing about immigration reform. And and in a sense, that question is maybe answered by a slide that you showed at the beginning, the Gallup survey. And that survey showed, in fact, that the numbers are not flat over the last decade or so. The numbers are getting worse in terms of this. That I think the number of people who believe in evolution has slid from 38% to 32% or something like that over the last decade.
Yeah.
Which coincides with, over that same period, with a spike in political polarization, and which in turn suggests a linkage between the two. And so I guess what I'm wondering is if you see that that's the case, that that the problem is not so much that young evangelicals are uncomfortable with the science, they're uncomfortable with the messenger. They feel that the messenger is politically biased. And so the challenge here is to somehow de-link this dialogue, as you put it, from the political shouting match.
I think that's absolutely true, that these are, I think we are religio-political creatures in profound ways. I think the U.S. is completely polarized on many of these points, and you know, we have an eminent social scientist, and many of you have covered this topic for a long time in the room, so I hope some of you will comment on this. But you know, I mentioned that trust is more important than impartation of knowledge. I didn't unpack it there. Madison's a bit of a weird place in that we have a lot of progressive evangelicals who are politically left of center, but theologically right of center. But we are an aberration. If you've been to Madison, that goes without saying, I suppose. But other parts of the country, this is absolutely true, that there is great suspicion based on a total package which involves a number of political issues. It involves questions that relate to whether or not there's an ecological crisis looming and a number of other things. And these tend to be all packaged into kind of one giant ball of yarn. And it's hard to untangle those threads in that giant ball of yarn. Very hard. But very important, I think, trying to get people to, I use this technical word, disambiguate. I think that's what we need to do. We need to disambiguate these issues. That is very hard work. It takes a lot of time. So I think some of you journalists in the room who have covered evangelicals, you know that there's a lot of mistrust out there. If you're from certain newspapers in the room or certain news outlets, you know that you give them your card and I'm not sure I want to talk to you. And so I think you're familiar with that pushback, just that kind of immediate pushback. And so I think maybe one of the things that journalists can do to help the American people, whether you're on the more conservative side of the journalistic spectrum in this room, and there are certainly some of you in that case are on the less conservative side, is for you not to just create one giant ball of yarn and perpetuate the problem. So to the extent that you can be more nuanced in teasing apart these different inputs to how evangelicals think about the world, you can help them think about the world. And so I really hope that you will try to do that. I know it's not easy, right? Because it's...
You have a follow-up, Robert?
Yeah, Jeff. Well, as a means of doing that, can you explain this creature in Madison, Wisconsin, you were referring to, the person who is politically to the left or religiously to the right?
Sure. There are quite a number of people in Madison who are evangelicals who voted Democratic in the last set of elections, including our gubernatorial elections that we just had. But they would go to the very large evangelical church in town. So what are the things that tend to characterize them? They tend to have a lot of concern about the environment. They have a lot of concern about social justice issues and they seem to find support for that in the scriptures, both the Old and the New Testaments. Jesus had a lot to say about the poor, for example, and about oppression, and so they find that those resonate really well. But they are evangelical in their outlook towards the Bible, towards the fundamental way that you become a Christian. So for evangelicals, this is by putting your trust in Christ, who you can't do anything on your own to become in a right relationship with God, and Jesus died for you, but you need to trust in what he has done for you. These are classical evangelical ideas about how one becomes a Christian. It's not by doing good things and being a good person first and foremost. Those come as a response to becoming a Christian. So all the things that are classically true about evangelicals, defined theologically, are true about them. But politically, they may be personally pro-life, which is one of the important issues here in the debate, but they will vote Democrat. So they're interesting. But I think Madison, when you go outside of Madison, it only takes about 15 minutes to get into total farmland, and then things really change. There, I think there is not there is the standard kind of alignment of conservative politics, particular brand of conservative politics, I would say, and distrust of certain kinds of intelligentsia. So that leads to the potential for some anti-intellectualism. It's not uniformly true. I've certainly met lots of very thoughtful people in all parts of the country, but
okay,
it makes it easier.
Will Salatin?
Jeff, thanks for the, that was an extremely useful taxonomy. Thank you very much. I have a sort of a short, straightforward question and then a little more complicated question. The short question is Joe Francis, and just to pick one person, impaired in his ability to do science by being a young Earth creationist? But let me set that aside and just have a little more complicated one. You used the phrase, I think it was literary cultural analysis.
Yep.
And I just wanted you to go on for that about that for like an hour, but I'll settle for a couple of minutes. What is that? Or let me put it this way. Can you pick a couple of biblical propositions and explain, show us how that tool, that way of reading, adds flexibility, so allowing reconciliation between scripture and scientific evidence? Does it in fact do that? Because to most of us who don't know much about this topic, we look at something like creationism and we think, well, these people read plain sense as what the text means to them, and that nails them down to things that science will not allow. But perhaps by using this idea of what the text meant to the people of the day, you're able to use to apply a kind of metaphoric interpretation in places, perhaps somehow it allows reconciliation between the scientific evidence and the religious text.
Sure, that's a great question. So let me deal with the first one. Joe is at a Christian college called the Master's College in Southern California, founded by a guy named John MacArthur. Some of you really know evangelical subculture might have heard that name. So it's not a research university. I will tell you that Joe was quite able to get a very good PhD and publish papers that are required to get a PhD at University of Michigan, even though he went on to Young Earth schools from there. And why was he able to do that? Well, it's because of the kind of science he was doing. Didn't really, your view on origins really didn't affect the kind of science that he was doing. So if you pick your science in a particular way, then there's really no, you don't have to face kind of the empirical conflict that seems to be created by young Earth creationism. So I think that's how, so he gets around that. There are many engineers who are young Earth creationists. Now, they buy into the operational utility of science, and in fact, evangelicals love technology. In fact, one of my colleagues at the University of Wisconsin, who's in the Communication Arts Department, wrote a book called Digital Jesus about fundamentalists finding each other on the internet and forming chat rooms. So there's an instrumental use of science that's incredibly, that evangelicals are incredibly enthused about. So you can compartmentalize, and that's one way that you can face that. I don't know anyone who works on geoscience there are some young Earth creationists who would say that they are geoscientists and have worked in the petroleum industry or things like that, but I don't know anyone who's working in that area or anything that involves where the science leads you to consider the age of the Earth or the universe who would be a young Earth creationist. So that says that for those people, who work in those areas, you can't do the kind of high-quality science that would be required to succeed in those areas. Okay, so the second question. So I think what I'm saying, let's take a good example. Out of the dust of the ground, the Lord made Adam. You know, this is the kind of language that's used in Genesis. Okay. A literal interpretation of that is that out of mineral components in the ground, a non-corporeal entity fashioned by sort of like Play-Doh putting a human together, and then it says breathe life into him. And the word for spirit, Holy Spirit got some mention yesterday. Well, the word for spirit is the same as wind or breath, and so it's hard to know what's being referred to there. But it becomes a living being. Now, my friend John Walton, who is a Hebrew scholar, would say, now what is that about? Now, if we want to read that as a textbook on human construction plans, it seems to say that the original humans were made from dust. And in fact, that's part of the funeral liturgy. You came from the dust, into dust you will return, right? So, but John would say, you know, the original readers would not have thought this was like human Play-Doh. They would not have thought that. They would have thought that this is an account that God created human beings, yes, but it doesn't really say anything about the material origins of human beings. And so that is very helpful. And most Bible scholars would say that you need to try to think like an ancient Hebrew receiving this text, someone from the ancient Near Eastern context, not someone from North America in the 21st century. So that it's a category error to read back into the text things that we want to see there. So that's an example of, if it's no longer about material origins, then how God created humans, if that's not actually what's being discussed there, now we have a lot more options about that. Now, whether all of those options are congruent with what the text is actually saying, we can talk about that. But I think you can see that moving to a more culturally savvy interpretive schema helps you to untangle our sense for using the Bible as a textbook from what its message to its original audience was saying. Now, Chris has actually written a whole book called The Bible Made Impossible, in which he addresses some of these issues. I didn't write that book. You can talk to Chris about that. But I think, but you can see how this frees us up to make the Bible a lot more possible, and it actually allows us to explore congruence with what modern science seems to say.
I have a sense you have a follow-up. Quickly, Will.
I'm just going to impersonate a young earth creationist for just a second here. It feels to me like what you're saying is a blanket justification for using metaphor.
Justification for what?
For using metaphor, that you're saying we're being faithful to the text as it was meant to be conveyed to these people, and it was all poetry.
Well, I was not saying that. Some people might say that. I would not say that. So, actually, John Walton would not say that. He would say real events lie behind the text, but they're not. It's not the kind of historiography, the blow-by-blow, mechanistically explained kind of sequence of historical events that you and I are used to in a modern history book. So don't look for that kind of thing there. That's what I'm saying. So, no, I think the Bible is not just a metaphorical collection of things that allow us to think nice thoughts about things that we want to think nice thoughts about. There are a lot of things there that I think there are positive statements being made in the Bible that we have to take seriously. But I want to be careful not to read into the text. See, you use the word metaphor. You and I have a shared understanding of that word from a 21st century perspective. That's a literary device that we understand is a non-literal literary device that conveys some sort of meaning. Now, I think there are such things in the Bible, most assuredly, but I don't think everything in the Bible is a metaphor.
Let me quickly, we've been mentioned John Walton several times. Jeff, he's Old Testament professor at Wheaton College. The name of that very important book he wrote about 2 years ago is what again?
It's called The Lost World of Genesis 1. It's the popular level book.
The Lost World of Genesis.
Lost World of Genesis 1. So this is the story about how God created the heavens and the earth and that whole six-day thing. And Rested on the Seventh.
Yeah. Very important book. Okay, yeah. Byron York and then David Rennie. Is your button on?
I believe I am.
Yeah.
Are we all now? I have a question. First, I wanted to ask you, you made a brief reference to a skeptics society in Madison. What's that?
What's that? This is a... So there's a well-known foundation in Madison called the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which has been involved in several lawsuits across the country, and that's not them, although they... The Venn diagram is there's a large region of overlap there. The particular guys who have come to the talks that I've given, they would consider themselves atheists. They run a thing on the Capitol Square in Madison called Pub Science, and they have speakers come in and talk about science. And so they're mainly advocates for good science. They weren't really there as skeptics of Christianity per se. They were more there as guardians of scientific accuracy. So, but they are skeptical of a lot of truth claims. So, a lot of them would like. I think they're big fans of Michael Shermer, for example. Some people may know him. That's who they are. And
next question.
Yeah.
Well, so the question is then, what's the role of the political system in all of this? You've talked about these various schools of thought, and we have state and local boards of education, we have federal education spending, you yourself are at a state university, so should the educational bureaucracy funded by taxpayer dollars, in your view, stick strictly to the straight science and let this whole burgeoning school of thought be covered by somebody else out there, either churches or somebody else? But in your view, should education money be strictly devoted to the straight scientific explanation?
I think science education should be about the science. Do I think there are many other things that students should be educated about? Absolutely. I think if you look at school boards across the country, I mentioned Eugenie Scott earlier. So she, the mission of her organization is to kind of hold state boards of education accountable for their textbook choices and what they're teaching about evolution. And whether or not you like the idea of standards, there's been a lot of discussion about that point. What kind of standards should educators be held to with regard to teaching about evolution? It's very clear that the state or the textbook adoptions are dominated by the most populous states. So California and Texas in particular are the benchmarks. So a textbook publishing company, if they can get their book into California and Texas, then they've succeeded. If they can't get it into those two states, it won't be an economically viable product. So there's tremendous pressure then to get books in approved through the state of California or the state of Texas. Now, I think you can guess that Texas will be more conservative on those points than California. And so there are a lot of discussions about what appropriate books are and where various disciplines should be covered in the curriculum. I mean, my own view about...
Is your textbook in Texas and California? Yours? Did we get it in there?
My college textbook? Yes, it is.
Good. I just...
I'm mentioning this because there are two approaches. One was the kind of the straight-up approach that was defeated by the celebrated court case in Dover, Pennsylvania, by using intelligent design texts in the biology classroom. That was defeated soundly, and that kind of set the current legal approach across the country to that point. So the discussion shifted to, okay, so we can't do that, but I don't find evolutionary biology very palatable, so I'm going to remove as much as I can of that from my high school biology textbook to make it more palatable to a Christian audience. And that, I find that disappointing. I mean, I would like there to be full-on coverage of the modern evolutionary biological mechanistic view of how all of this works. I'm of the opinion, though, which we don't often have, I certainly didn't have it in my public high school, we don't have a course where we can talk about the meta issues that surround science. That never gets discussed. Like, where is that going to be discussed? The main place that that's discussed in a, like a Catholic high school curriculum is in a religion or philosophy class. We don't have those classes at most public high schools. So that's the problem. There's no, where can we discuss issues like metaphysical naturalism? Now, that's a philosophical or worldview issue. It's not a scientific issue. I would argue it's not a scientific entailment. Yet, there's no good place for students to get exposed to teasing apart philosophy of science from science, metaphysics from physics. So we don't have good places in the curriculum. So if I were rewriting the curriculum, I would want a space for that. And I'm not advocating for, I have a German degree, I'm not advocating for the German approach, which is to have kind of a incredibly vanilla religion class that all students, by all accounts, just endure and don't really listen to what's being covered there. I'd rather
David
have
Rennie calls
like
a soggy view.
Soggy religion. Okay, yeah, that's helpful.
Okay, David Rennie, you're up next. And I'm trying to, we have a lot of people to get in, and we want to take a break for some of you all to check out. So.
Yeah, I have it's just a kind of request for you to expand a bit on. You threw in a fairly kind of startling fact, which is actually you were drawing on John Evans's research in San Diego, that you talked about trust being more important than data, and you had this idea that a substantial number of these evangelicals who are taking a lot of science classes, who are not ignorant, their problem is that they need to be persuaded that most scientists do not systematically skew the data. But that's kind of an unreasonable position, isn't it? I mean, does that square with your view of how scientists operate? And can you expand on how important that is as a suspicion?
Well, I think if you talk to the evangelical on the street, some of them have overt mistrust. They do believe that, I think, that they're not getting the full story in college, to be sure. So there's a lot of people who learn what they need to do to get an A in the class, spit back what the professor wants to tell them, but they don't believe what they just spit back on the exam to get the A, right? So there are certainly evangelicals out there like that. I mean, the students that I interact with, which is a very limited sample, I don't think they believe there's a massive conspiracy to skew data. I don't think that's what John is getting at. But he is getting at the idea that when what I seem to be learning in some discipline collides with my worldview, then my impulse is to distrust the message and the messenger. And Christian will have much more to say about that for young adults, and I hope maybe he can weigh in on this.
In fact, he just you went in on this point. Pull the mic over, Chris.
I think very few.
Pull the microphone over, please. The microphone.
I think very few evangelicals would.
And turn it on, please.
It is. Would suspect that scientists are somehow cooking their data,
right,
or at a micro level they're doing something dishonest. I think it mostly is driven by the observation, and I think it's an accurate observation, that some of the most vocal atheist science activists very easily and unselfconsciously switch between methodological naturalism and metaphysical naturalism. They just jump from, I'm an expert, and they genuinely are experts in ant zoology, to making these grandiose claims about cosmic meaning and so on, and that they can't see that they're making that switch themselves. And so it's this more macro, like, if these really smart people, because they're driven by atheism, can't see they've changed the subject now, they're speaking philosophically without any grounding for that, then that just presents this, well, wait a minute, this general, wait a minute, I'm not sure, I've got to put a hard line in the sand now and really be suspicious. I really don't think that there's a general sense they're making up their data, they're falsifying the facts. I think it's a more general, there's an agenda that some people have on atheological grounds that I have to be deeply suspicious about.
It's probably worth pointing out, too, that I don't know how it is in the UK, but certainly in the US, there's a culture of suspicion sometimes. So if these nagging doubts in your mind make it epistemically more difficult for you to be open to new information, right? This is true whether you're on the left or you're on the right. I mean, we know this is true in many areas, right? So I think this is what John was getting at, is that students have a hard time disentangling what E.O. Wilson, the ant guy, says about ants and their social biology from what he says about lack of meaning and purpose for all of human existence. They can't see where to make those dividing lines. I guess that's why, you know, I'm a bit reluctant to be at meetings like this, frankly. I'm just kind of a professor, right? But I think it's why people like me or social scientists like Chris need to be out there talking about this a little bit, because the students need the freedom to see that that's true. They need guidance to learn how to tease this apart. So that's a process that they need to be taught, and unfortunately we're not doing a good job of that.
Okay, Michael Paulson, pull the mic over, and you'll take us into the break, and then at the break, for 15 minutes, those of you who have not checked out can check out, and we'll get back to the Q&A after that. Michael?
I'm curious about how open you are with your colleagues and students about your own faith, your own ideas about the role that God does or does not play in evolution, and how, I mean, you're a tenured chair of a department at a large research university. Could you have been open about your views when you were a doctoral candidate, when you were climbing the academic ladder? What are the consequences in academia for the kind of beliefs, association, even the willingness to engage in discussion that you are having?
Oh, there's several layers to that question. Let me start with the first one. So one never knows what one's friends and colleagues say about one behind closed doors when one is not present. So, but you know, I've not really had any issues with any of my colleagues. You know, the fact that I'm a department chair, I think people have a lot of confidence in me. Seemingly, I don't know. I'm not sure whether that's warranted confidence, but they seem to have some confidence in me as an administrator and as a leader of our department. What I think people are looking very closely for is whether I am true to the biological data, whether I'm true to the science. And they're really concerned about that. So if there were any sense that I were soft on science, I'd be in a lot of trouble. I would not have the respect of my colleagues. So, it's pretty well known that I'm a Christian in my department. And that has not been an issue. Now, I personally have been a pretty big champion for hiring evolutionary biologists. We just finished a search. A guy coming from the American Museum of Natural History is going to join our department. He works on something called EvoDevo, the relationship of development to evolution. He happens to work on daddy long leg spiders. He goes dark in caves in Laos to hunt these creatures for months at a time and bring them back and extract their DNA and stuff. It's pretty cool. So, so I think they sense that I'm not trying to shift to the department to somehow fit my own faith commitments. So that's been okay. What we tried to do at Wisconsin is to try. A friend of mine, a very eminent historian of science named Ron Numbers, and I started a group called the Isthmus Society. Madison is built on an isthmus between two land masses. There's a lake on the north and a lake on the south. And the idea is to connect religion and science by a little strip of land, right? So that's the word picture. But, you know, we've always tried to have a spectrum of views presented. And I think what allows people to relax is to make sure that their view is represented.
Yeah. Well, let me try once more. Where are you on the taxonomy that you put up there, and do you share that with your students?
I'm an evolutionary creationist. I don't teach evolutionary biology, so it doesn't come up in my class. I do self-identify as a Christian, I teach a course on embryonic development, and I know most of the students aren't going to take a course in bioethics, and so I do a little bioethics. I sneak it in because I believe it's important for them to be citizens in a country that's...
But so you believe...
So then I self-identify as a Christian in those contexts, you know.
What does that mean as an evolutionary biologist? Like, do you believe God plays a role in guiding evolution, launching it?
I believe that the standard evolutionary picture is correct. We can talk about how God specifically acts in scientific or natural processes. I mean, God's activity is an important idea to talk about. You know, how does he act? How is he tweaking the system? Is he tweaking it? You know, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. I do believe God created the world with the intention that we would be here and that we would one day be capable of interacting with him. But, you know, I don't really have a detailed mechanism for how that works. I just accept the evidence for evolution as incredibly strong. And
that's why you're on the board of the Biologos Foundation, founded by Francis Collins. And by the way, we have a representative, if you haven't met Catherine yet, is here from the Biologos Foundation. You had a follow-up to that?
No.
Okay, good. Then we're going to... Carl, you'll lead us in when we come back. Carl and Emma and Sarah and Shadi and Knapp and David Gregory. And so if we could get back here, really try hard to get back in 15 minutes, we continue this wonderful discussion.